The issue of identity has been a preoccupation of the church from its inception. The question of what kind of people God has called into being confronts the church in every age. It is an inescapable and unavoidable issue. As Presbyterian theologian John Leith comments, the Christian community that has survived has always taken seriously the integrity of its own identity. Indeed, I would argue the issues of identity and integrity are indivisible. The absence of a clear and evident identity robs the church of its integrity and witness. A faltering sense of identity now threatens both the evangelical movement and the Southern Baptist Convention. Both have struggled with these issues through the 1980s and into the 1990s. Pride indeed comes before a fall. The year 1976 should stand as a reminder that confusion concerning identity is a recipe for ferment. In that year, Newsweek magazine declared the year of the evangelical, and Southern Baptists gathered to adopt what became known as Bold Mission Thrust. Within 3 years, both groups would be embroiled in deep soul-searching and conflict. I would remind us that Southern Baptists are accustomed to asking questions of identity, but they are not accustomed to asking this question in terms of internal debate. The question of Southern Baptist identity at the turn of the century was forged not internally, but externally. The book Baptist Why and Why Not, published at the turn of the century, I would remind you, had chapters Baptist and why not Presbyterian, Baptist and why not Episcopalian, Baptist and why not Methodist, Baptist and why not Campbellite, not Baptists one sort versus another. However, external threats in the presence of other religious bodies with competing truth claims is no longer, this issue is now no longer the major defining issue over against which Southern Baptists are defining themselves. By the turn of the 20th century, Southern Baptists, though diverse in geography, worship tradition, and certain practices, had developed a consensus of conservative theology shaped around a modified Calvinism and cooperative methodology. Southern Baptists generally assumed a common identity based on doctrinal commitments, missionary vision, and distinctive Baptist practices. But by mid-century, Southern Baptists were forced to confront basic identity issues in what one Southern Baptist historian termed an identity crisis. With considerable foresight, W.R. Estep predicted that Southern Baptists were, quote, entering a crisis of major proportions. As he stated before the controversy, the nature of the problems confronting the denomination are so varied and complex they tend to defy analysis. In the face of bewildering cross-currents that now course through an increasingly heterogeneous denomination is a problem that, to some extent, encompasses all the others, the question of identity. He got the question right. I believe he got the answer wrong, but that's another story. Whether prompted by external or internal forces, the issue of identity has shaped virtually every major conflict in Baptist history. Historian William Brackney once said Southern Baptist history is replete with identity crises and self-doubt. This is the most recent issue, the identity crisis, underlying the current Southern Baptist controversy. Rival visions of Baptist identity now compete for power and majoritarian status within the convention. Both visions, now organized into opposing parties, claim to represent real Baptists, and identity rhetoric is employed generously by both sides in the denominational struggle. Who are the real Baptists? Are they the Southern Baptists who define themselves primarily by identification with so-called Baptist distinctives, such as religious freedom, soul competency, and the priesthood of believers? This party I would identify as the Liberty Party, locates Baptist identity in these affirmations and resists any move toward greater theological and doctrinal specificity. Their presuppositions rule out substantive and enforceable doctrinal parameters. Though historic Baptist confessions are acknowledged, they are treated as merely illustrative of what some Baptists believed at one time, and they serve no regulative function. Proposals for more clearly defined parameters are met with cries of creedalism and coercion. The other party, I would identify as the Truth Party, defines Baptist identity in terms of continuity with the conservative theological traditions which shaped and sustained the Southern Baptist Convention, relatively unthreatened from its birth until the middle of the 20th century. Proponents point to the classical orthodoxy of the denomination's founders, the unmolested continuation of that tradition well into the 20th century, and the conservative doctrinal positions uniformly taken by the convention itself, including the 1925 and 1963 versions of the Baptist Faith and Message. They define themselves over against the more revisionist and accommodationist theological positions and resist any theological compromise on core beliefs. Religious liberty and soul competence are affirmed, but with the presupposition that these Baptist emphases were developed as a protection against the coercive power of the state or some overarching ecclesiastical authority, as in Roman Catholicism, and not against the self-determination of a voluntary association, such as the convention itself. The Southern Baptist Convention was, we must admit, born in a pre-critical age, that is, before the influence of critical methodologies and theological modernism. Yet by 1859 and the founding of the denomination's first theological seminary, the move toward clearly defined doctrinal parameters was evident. As the founders of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary made clear, the statement of faith was to have an enforceable regulative authority. The Southern Baptist Convention has been caught in a tension between, and this is an argument I have made elsewhere and will repeat here, the Southern Baptist Convention has been caught and is now caught in a tension between what can be assumed and what must be articulated. In 1845, the convention could assume almost universal agreement on the core doctrines of the classical Christian tradition. There were no debates over the atonement in 1845. There were no debates over Christology or the authority of Scripture in 1845. And such debates would have been absolutely out of context had such occurred. The questions simply were not asked. By the way, I was just struck by something. This has been noted before, but I happen to be writing a chapter in a book of theologians responding to neo-Darwinism, the new Darwinist models. And in the providence of God, the Origin of Species and the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary emerged within weeks of each other. And at least one biographer of Boyce says that on Boyce's desk when he died was a copy of the Origin of Species, which is a very interesting footnote. Stay tuned for that chapter. By the 1960s, it could no longer be assumed that Southern Baptists stood in unity on these core theological beliefs. Modernity now forces the convention to articulate more clearly what it once could assume. And I think if we do not understand this, we can't possibly relate to the contemporary issues in the Southern Baptist Convention. Why must these issues be articulated now? For the very important reason that they were assumed before. There's an important principle of historical theology we ought always to keep in mind, and that is, in terms of formulation, in terms of precise statement, heresy almost always precedes orthodoxy. Because the orthodox statement, whether it's the Nicene Creed or the Athanasian Creed, or the Baptist Faith and Message Statement, is adopted to clarify and assert what has in some form been denied or questioned. And if we don't understand that, the church didn't decide to get together in Nicaea because it was a nice resort community and it would be a nice relaxed theological symposium. No, it was the Arian threat to the integrity of the faith that prompted that meeting. Identity throughout remains the issue. Card-carrying members of the Truth Party and their opposites in the Liberty Party are unlikely to coexist side by side indefinitely. The battle for denominational control is now in the hands of the Truth Party, but that has not settled all the issues of identity for the convention. The overwhelming electoral support garnered by conservative candidates in SBC elections indicates that a majority of Southern Baptists agree that a process of denominational renewal must include theological recovery and the establishment of articulated and regulative doctrinal parameters. So the Southern Baptist Convention remains in an identity crisis. Its future will be determined by whether or not it will be able to solve that identity crisis and still remain Southern Baptist, evangelical, and intact. American evangelicals find themselves in a similar quandary. Indeed, the story of the evangelical movement in America is, in essence, a narrative of a conservative stratum of American Protestantism in search of an identity which is neither fundamentalist nor liberal. The essays in this volume, that is the Southern Baptist and American Evangelicals volume that I reference here, use the term evangelical in a way that makes clear it is itself an issue of debate. Since the root of the word relates to the gospel itself, few Christian groups would eschew the word altogether. As a matter of fact, many who are clearly outside the evangelical movement and outside evangelical conviction nonetheless wish to claim the label. But in its most common usage, the term identifies the conservative wing of American Protestantism and is most specifically identified with the movement which emerged out of fundamentalism in the 1940s and 50s when leaders such as Carl F. H. Henry, Bernard Ramm, E.J. Carnell, Harold J. Ockenguy, and Billy Graham sought to define a movement that would remain true to all the theological fundamentals, but would differ from fundamentalism in terms of its engagement of the culture. Rather than being insular and inward, evangelicalism would retain the theological convictions while being outwardly focused and ambitious in terms of influence in the culture. The roots of the evangelical movement and fundamentalism are apparent and acknowledged, yet it also lays claim to a more comprehensive, and in its best moments, it lays claim to a more comprehensive continuity with the classical tradition of the church. The young leaders, soon labeled the New Evangelicals at mid-century, defined themselves against the obscurantism, separatism, and the cultural isolation of American fundamentalism, but also equally defined themselves against what was then clear, that is, not only the roots but the fruits of modernist or liberal theology and the revisionist tendencies already then apparent in the mainline churches. The term New Evangelicalism, first coined by Ockenguy but popularized by Henry and Carnell, was an attempt to link the new movement with a classical evangelical tradition, a tradition which represented a bold and comprehensive orthodoxy without the separatism which had come to characterize American fundamentalism by the 30s. By the 1960s, the new was dropped and evangelicalism remained, identifying the network movement and subculture which emerged or reoriented themselves under the leadership of the New Evangelicals. But I would remind us that the present hour finds evangelicals no less than Southern Baptists in the grip of a severe identity crisis. The pressures of modernity and the presence of rival claims to the evangelical mantle have forced this identity crisis with renewed urgency. Some are ready to dispense with the word altogether. Harold Lindzell, a former editor of Christianity Today and one of the early faculty members at Fuller Theological Seminary, has suggested that the accommodationist tendencies of modern evangelicals should prompt the genuinely orthodox to reclaim the label fundamentalist. From a different perspective, Donald W. Dayton and William Abraham suggest that evangelical is, quote, an essentially contested concept, end quote. That is, a term or concept which produces more confusion than clarity. Speaking of the word Abraham, and both Abraham and Dayton come from the Wesleyan tradition, Abraham comments, and here I quote, "The term is generally used in a mode of appraisal. It is rarely a purely neutral or descriptive term. It is employed to accredit some kind of achievement generally valued by those who apply the term to themselves. The achievement in mind is internally complex. There is no single essence or one particular condition that captures the achievement concerned or will be agreed upon by all evangelicals," end quote. Now, I will not take this into an extended discussion as I do in what I have written, but that can be true of almost any word. I mean, what Abraham says here is virtually meaningless. You could pick any word in the dictionary and say the same thing. In fact, someone as radical as Noam Chomsky says that is the essence of language. But that's another story. Stay tuned for that chapter as well. Those ready to jettison the term tend to represent the fringes of the evangelical movement, I would argue. Either those on the evangelical right who never were quite ready to abandon fundamentalist separatism, or those on the left whose revisionist tendencies cannot be accommodated in the evangelical tent and who find themselves increasingly more at home in the maelstrom of whatever is left of mainline Protestantism. For the most part, the term continues to function with a sufficient, if incomplete, clarity of usage. It is indeed that clarity of usage which is offensive to those who oppose the term. The central issue in the identity quest is what constitutes the essence of evangelical faith and the unity which produced the evangelical movement. If who are the genuine Southern Baptists is an issue of debate, so is the question, who are the authentic evangelicals? With parallels to the Southern Baptist dynamic, many evangelicals are defined between what I would identify as an experience party and a doctrine party. The experience party seeks to define evangelicalism in terms of a common experience of conversion and the Christian life. Wesleyan, holiness, Pentecostal, and charismatic strains of the evangelical movement often claim this as the central ingredient to evangelical definition. To those strains must be added others whose image of evangelicalism was formed by revivalism. The Doctrine Party identifies evangelicalism with a bold advocacy of the Orthodox Christian tradition, including the unblemished authority of Holy Scripture. While also insistent on the necessity of personal experience and conversion, the Doctrine Party seeks to defend the faith once delivered and to witness to classical orthodoxy while surrounded by a culture of increasing compromise. We can see this conflict played out now in both evangelical and Southern Baptist life. A people caught in an identity crisis will naturally look to their historical roots for guidance. Divided as they are on so many issues, Southern Baptists cannot agree on the essence of their historical roots and development. Torn in previous generations by battles over Baptist secessionism, or sometimes called landmarkism, as was one variant, the current division falls along different lines. Southern Baptists are confronted with rival historiographies as well as rival denominational visions. The Liberty Party holds a libertarian historiography which treats Southern Baptist history largely in terms of a people born in dissent who became the advocates of religious liberty and unfettered freedom of conscience. The sine qua non of Baptist identity is liberty. As the title of a recent book published by the Southern Baptist Alliance, as it was at the time of the publication of the book known, suggests, quote, being Baptist means freedom. The problem is, of course, that Baptist identity becomes nothing more than libertarianism, and one cannot tell the difference between the Southern Baptist Convention as hereby envisioned and the American Civil Liberties Union. Other Baptists contend for an historical perspective which includes a much greater attention to the Orthodox faith of early Baptists and their heirs. Baptist advocacy of religious liberty and the freedom of conscience, this advocacy has not, we remind, prevented Baptist churches, associations, and conventions from drawing tangible doctrinal parameters and confessing their common faith in straightforward terms. Evangelicals are likewise divided. Advocates of the Wesleyan Pentecostal traditions charge that the traditional evangelical historiography identifies the movement in the main with what they term the Reformed Presbyterian Baptist strain, which was most formative in the new evangelicalism. These conflicting visions and versions of evangelical history shape the debate over evangelical identity. What theological limits then conscribe Baptist and evangelical identity? As I've already stated, some Baptists resist the very notion of any regulative theological parameter. No authority external to the individual should, they argue, coerce or lay claim upon the individual conscience. Nor should any advocacy or embrace of confessional positions be required. Others regard this as beside the point. Coercion is not at all the issue, these Baptists say, but the right and responsibility of a denominational body to set limits upon acceptable doctrinal diversity. The SBC Peace Committee, established in the 1985 Southern Baptist Convention in Dallas, became a battleground for these two competing positions and thus these two rival visions of Baptist identity. It mirrored the conflict in the denomination at large. Conservatives, frustrated that their quest for some enforceable doctrinal specificity had been met with great resistance, were successful in detailing not only the general theological shape of the problem and the fact that the problem was essentially theological, but even in achieving four very specific theological determinations. But they were unsuccessful in their effort to move the issues from the findings section of the report to recommendations. That appeared very important in 1987. It is not considered important any longer. The course of the Southern Baptist conflict has revealed the fault line between those who feel that greater doctrinal specificity and a more regulative status for Baptist confessional documents is a necessary corrective to a process of doctrinal accommodation, and on the other side, those who feel that such a move is antithetical to the Baptist spirit. The same issue plagues evangelicalism. In both contexts, the key issues of debate have been the authority and interpretation of the Bible. Biblical inerrancy, which emerged as a key issue of evangelical debate in the 1970s, emerged at the same time in the Southern Baptist Convention. It continues to divide evangelicals and Southern Baptists, though studies indicate that a majority of both evangelicals and Southern Baptists wholeheartedly embrace the doctrine. Likewise, exegetical issues and current hermeneutical movements have produced varied responses. What are the limits of legitimate evangelical biblical hermeneutics? Redaction criticism, questions of historicity, the influence of feminist hermeneutics, narrative hermeneutics, postmodern hermeneutics, deconstructionism, reader response issues, and other developments divide both evangelical and Southern Baptist ranks. The issue is this: how can a denomination such as the Southern Baptist Convention, or a trans-denominational movement such as American Evangelicalism, maintain either identity or integrity without careful attention to the acceptable limits of doctrinal diversity? Furthermore, when do issues of doctrinal diversity finally reach the limits of belief and unbelief? Rampant theological pluralism is the natural and unavoidable product of a parameterless theological environment. The theological confusion which marks the mainline churches provides abundant evidence of what an ideology of sheer pluralism produces. Mirroring Anglican claims of comprehensiveness, mainline churches have attempted to open themselves to any and all theological positions and have become, in large part, a discordant mass of confusion. As Leonard Sweet, one of the most interesting and eclectic commentators on the American religious scene, has said, theological pluralism, quote, became the fairy godmother of modern Protestantism, non-inclusivism its wicked stepfather. Furthermore, denominations committed to pluralism had become, as he said, quote, a veritable flea market of faiths. At least one mainline body, which happens to be located in Louisville, Kentucky, has, quote, an office of pluralism, end quote, acknowledging the status of the inclusivist agenda. Reflecting on the process of the pluralist agenda, one inside observer in that denomination acknowledged that, quote, such a church is destined to capitulate within its own life the divisions of the culture and that its theology will enjoy no sanctuary from that painful process, end quote. What doctrinal standards apply, or are such standards considered to be hopelessly non-inclusive and coercive? Richard G. Hutchison commented a few years ago about the mainline Protestant world, and here I quote, while doctrinal standards establish general parameters, they are seldom applied in a way excluding anyone. Even candidates for the clergy in mainline denominations are more likely to be rejected for excessive narrowness than for violation of confessional standards. As for the laity, one can hardly conceive a belief, idiosyncrasy, or variance which would possibly disqualify a layperson conscientiously and sincerely seeking membership in a mainline church. If you were watching, that was said, I believe now over 10 years ago. If you are watching the current debates, you could extend that now to those who are candidates for ordination. Evangelicals and Southern Baptists have much to learn by observing this process in other communions and in the mainline Protestant movement. The issues of doctrinal standards and parameters, and the determination of a proper mode of confessionalism will determine whether or not Southern Baptist and evangelical bodies are willing to follow the mainline model. Now, I'm skipping over a great deal here. Like so many issues of debate in the Southern Baptist conflict, the question of whether Southern Baptists are evangelicals must be clarified before any answer can be offered. A historical perspective reveals that Southern Baptists were most certainly considered a part of the evangelical alliance of the 19th century. Similarly, Southern Baptists largely accepted the label fundamentalist before the term took on a militant, separatist, and uncooperative connotation in the 1930s. The essays that were exchanged and the articles which were published in Southern Baptist literature in the 1920s indicates that Southern Baptists assumed they belonged with the fundamentalists, as they were increasingly known theologically, and it was only in the next decade when that term took on a very negative connotation, somewhat essentially connected also with the Scopes trial, that the term became one that many sought to eschew. The issue of Baptist identity is again determinative. Those who define Southern Baptist identity in terms of a libertarian experiential tradition are prone to see the Baptist tradition and contemporary evangelical movements at odds. Glenn Henson has suggested that the name Baptist, quote, refers to that version of the Christian faith which places the priority of voluntary and uncoerced faith or response to the word and act of God over any supposed objective word and act of God, end quote. With this definition of Baptist identity as the presupposition, Henson sees the evangelical movement as a threat to Baptist voluntarism. Evangelicals, he charges, are, quote, preoccupied with orthodoxy, end quote, and with missionary zeal, quote, are infusing their outlook deeper and deeper into Southern Baptist life, end quote. The problem is, of course, that outlook has always been deep in Southern Baptist life. Leon Macbeth at Southwestern Seminary reveals a very similar concern. He sees evangelicals, quote, as militant, anti-denominational, and anti-ecclesiastical, end quote, bodies. Quote, I do not want to be either an evangelical or a fundamentalist, at least as I understand the terms, end quote, he suggests. I would suggest that both Henson and Macbeth read evangelicalism through fundamentalist colored glasses. They seem to be unable to distinguish between separatistic and militant fundamentalism, such as that modeled by J. Frank Norris and Bob Jones Sr., and the evangelical movement of the last 20th century, of the late 20th century, excuse me. It's the last and only 20th century. Just how unpreoccupied with orthodoxy should a Baptist denomination be, we might ask. Baptists who limit their vision of evangelical identity to militant fundamentalism and who base their vision of Baptist identity on a spiritual voluntarism which will abide no doctrinal parameters will naturally attempt to put distance between the Baptist heritage and the evangelical movement. Others clearly see the issue in starkly different terms. Seeing the Baptist heritage as a wedding of uncoerced experiential faith with classical orthodoxy, these Southern Baptists see American evangelicals as esteemed allies with many shared concerns and an overarching common commitment to the gospel. Thus, maintaining that Southern Baptists have a unique contribution to make to the evangelical movement, James Leo Garrett suggests the label of, quote, denominational evangelicals for Southern Baptists. Evangelicals, to be sure, but denominational is the character, shape, and timbre of the particular evangelicalism modeled by Southern Baptists. If Southern Baptists are not evangelicals, just how in the world would Southern Baptists be classified? The fact of the matter is that Southern Baptists are increasingly seen as evangelicals, and any listing of American evangelicals by disinterested observers always lists the Southern Baptist Convention. A case can be made that Southern Baptists were, until the late 1970s, following a trajectory in keeping with the pattern, nonetheless, of mainline Protestantism, although about 50 years behind. That trajectory has now been slowed, perhaps abated, perhaps reversed. But the future course of the Southern Baptist experiment is not yet clear. In terms of core beliefs, Southern Baptists are, with very few exceptions, clearly evangelical. Participants at the Evangelical Affirmations Conference held at the turn of this decade, organized by Carl Henry and Kenneth Conser, adopted a statement which listed three marks of evangelical identity. These were, one, belief in the gospel as set forth in Scripture, salvation through grace by faith. Two, commitment to the basic doctrines of the Bible as found, for instance, in the Apostles' Creed and other historic confessions. This identified as the material or content principle of evangelicalism. And thirdly, an acknowledgement of the Bible as the authoritative and final source of all doctrines. This identified as the formative or forming principle. The vast majority of Southern Baptists clearly fit within this definition and would gladly join in these critical affirmations. The best hope for the recovery of the Southern Baptist Convention lies in the discovery, rediscovery, and reclamation of an authentic and distinctive Southern Baptist evangelicalism, genuinely Baptist and genuinely evangelical. This Baptist evangelicalism would protect the historic Baptist emphasis on religious liberty and uncoerced faith, but it would also contend for the integrity of Orthodox doctrine and the necessity of confessional parameters. It would reaffirm Southern Baptist's commitment to the Great Commission and at the same time realize that the gospel itself is that which is most threatened by the acids of modernity. Southern Baptists have much to learn from the evangelical movement and much to teach in return. Evangelicals have traversed much of the same ground Southern Baptists are now contesting, and the Southern Baptist conflict has taken place within the context of a major cultural and ideological shift in the life of the Western world, a shift which adds great urgency to the development of evangelical solidarity. As Robert Wuthnow at Princeton and others observe, American religious life is now marked by an unmistakable fault line which divides religious liberals from conservatives. This divide is more firmly established and plays a far more pivotal role than divisions between denominational traditions, geographical regions, or congregational styles. The vast majority of Southern Baptists and American evangelicals stand unashamedly on the same side of that divide. Let me state clearly, the greatest danger is that Southern Baptists will not meet the challenge of the present hour and recover an authentic Baptist evangelicalism. Southern Baptists are now in a period of reconstruction. The future shape of the convention must avoid the twin dangers of obscurantist, angry, and separatist fundamentalism on the right and revisionist compromise on the left. In between lies the evangelical option, an ironic, bold, and convictional posture which combines concern for orthodox doctrine with a spirit of engagement with the larger world and commitment to the missionary mandate of the church. Without abandoning that which is distinctive to the Baptist heritage, we should link arms in a common witness to the truth of the gospel, to the full truthfulness and authority of Holy Scripture, to the necessity of redemption through Christ's atoning work and the gift of faith, to the uniqueness of Jesus the Christ and salvation through him alone. We must recommit ourselves to the missionary mandate of the Great Commission and to the nature of the church as a peculiar people, willing to bear the scandal of the cross for the high calling of bearing witness to the gospel for Christ's sake. In so doing, Southern Baptists and American evangelicals must claim continuity with those who from the first century onward have been the genuine evangels of the gospel. For as darkness falls and unbelief gains, we are called to hold forth a light which the world cannot dim.